lesson 18. I have a few more final comments to make on lesson 17 that in my haste I wasn't sure that I made them very clear. But in the matter of Balaam and his causing the Israelites to sin, verse 16 in chapter 31 of Numbers is very significant. You may remember that when Balaam was supposed to make the curses, but instead he made blessings those three times, one of the comments he made relative to Israel was that Israel was one in whom God found no iniquity. And so, since there was no iniquity, it was not possible for them to be cursed. They were the object of, they were God's special people, the object of all his blessings. But the way in which he caused them to sin, and that was the point I wanted to make in chapter 31, verse 16. God, would you close that door back there, or echo for the hallway? Chapter 31, verse 16 is significant. Verse 15, Moses said unto them, have you saved all the women alive? This was referring to the captives that the Israelite soldiers brought back. And referring to them in verse 16, he says, behold, these caused the children of Israel to sin, children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. So Balaam apparently had rendered counsel or offered advice to Balak, the king of Moab. And so all of what was done relative to the women and their seducing the people, the men in particular, into ritual fornication and participate in idolatrous worship was all because of the counsel of Balaam. One other comment, and I'll close with this. I've made several comments on Balaam's character, his weaknesses as they are described in the Bible. Absolutely remarkable when you start trying to run a trace on how many times Balaam and his sin, or Balak and his stumbling, are referred to in the Bible. It's mentioned again in the book of Deuteronomy. It's mentioned in the book of Joshua at least twice. It's mentioned by Jephthah in the book of Judges. And none of these are, by the way, in the lesson I handed out for last week. It's mentioned by Nehemiah. It's mentioned by Micah, the Old Testament. It's mentioned again in the New Testament by Peter, Jude, and of course John when he wrote the Revelation letter. So this is a significant thing going on here. And it becomes a typical example to show how one who should be serving God is answerable for not having done so. And in this case, Balaam in particular is noted as one who pursued or ran greedily after the reward of error. Upheld error. He did not uphold truth. He expected reward because of his position relative to error and bringing it about. And he caused others to sin. The passage in Revelation chapter 2 says that Balaam cast a stumbling block before Balak. Of course, I take Balak to refer not just to him personally, but to him and for all the people he stood for as the federal head of those Moabite people. So he is the cause of all of that and a notable character to be remembered. And, of course, he died, was one of those killed along with the five princes or kings in the land of Midian. Also mentioned that the war was made against Midian. Yet the Bible makes it very clear that between the Midianites and the Moabites, a couple of other things I want to mention. You'd think with this war and the killing of the men of war and ultimately killing of the women who had participated in all of this activity that they brought back as captives, killing all the male sons and so on, the Midianites were wiped out. Clearly, if you read the Bible, this is not the case. There's nothing intimated here, but one can only draw the conclusion that this is a major subset of Midianite people. The Midianites come back again and again in the book of Judges and trouble the Israelites. So this is not the end of them. That's number one. Number two, the Moabites, Moses says later, we may come across this, that as far as Moab was concerned, there was not to be a Moabite person to enter into the congregation even unto the 10th generation. And never should Israel seek their well-being. But he also went on and said, relative to Edom, which was nearby, that they should never abhor or hate Edom. So he's making a distinction between Edom, whom they should not abhor or hate, versus Moab and the people of that land who caused this great difficulty. Any comments on this before we move on? I thought those were worthy concluding comments that I wanted to bring to your attention before we left this subject. Well, this all happened relative to Balaam. We concluded that story, but it was a significant story over several chapters relative to what was going on to the people of Israel while they were camped on the plains of Moab, overlooking the Jordan River and Jericho across the river. This incident is recorded. But there's several other things went on while they were camped there as they prepare to go into the land of promise. And that is where we're going to be studying in this class. So if you'll look at your lesson 18, which I handed out to you, that's where we will be going tonight. It's looking at these other events coming up on the plains of Moab before they enter into the promised land. This particular material begins with the fact that God asked that there be a second census made of the men of war. And you want to recall here that there had been a previous census made that we talked about in one of our classes. I think it was maybe our second or third class, but we studied Numbers chapter 1, 1 through 3. And God asked this count be of the same men, that is, men of war, and under the same requirements, that is, those able to go to war, those 20 years of age and older. And so here they are camped on the plains of Moab, and they go about this counting in the same way, and this count is taken at the end of their wilderness wandering, whereas the other one was taken when they first left Mount Sinai. I have here the table we showed you before. I titled the columns a little bit different. Back then at Sinai, as the number as recorded in chapter 1, here in chapter 26. And then also we briefly commented on numbering the Levites again. And they are counted and this time found to be 23,000 males above the age of 1 month. I don't think I put the word males in there. I should have. This census follows the plague associated with the death of all these people at Baal Peor, which we studied last week. When this census was completed, it was found that not a single man of war remained of all those that had been numbered by Moses the first time, except for Joshua and Caleb. And thus we see that it is fulfilled, even as the Lord has said, they shall surely die in the wilderness. Based on Numbers chapter 14, 28 through 35, what God has said has come to pass. This census reveals some interesting things, and that is that it points out that Korah had died in his rebellion, but his sons had not died. I thought that was interesting. It makes a good point for us to understand that God is not capricious or vindictive. You look at pagan worship and idols, oftentimes there was not only the death of someone like Korah, but would have been all his children as well. But his sons did not die in that rebellion. Census showed this about some of the tribes, that some had changed little. We talked about this before, but we didn't delineate it. Simeon was down about 62%. Issachar and Manasseh were up considerably, one by a little over 10,000, one by about 20,000 people. Another event that we find here, and I think it's interesting, and we'll talk about why in just a minute, but let's look at this incident. There is a character here by the name of Zelophehad, and I thought about what a name for a person to have, Zelophehad. Why didn't they name him maltodextrin or dextromorphin or something like that? But Zelophehad. He was of the tribe of Manasseh. He had five daughters. And if you study this account, run all the references, we actually have the names of those daughters. I did not list them here. Zelophehad had died in his own sins, his daughter said, in the wilderness. By that, he was just one of those who had rebelled at the beginning at Kadesh Barnea, but he had not been one of those who died in the rebellion of Korah, for instance. He had a right to inherit land and the promised land, but his inheritance right to that land could not be passed on since he had no sons. This is a dilemma that they see. That seemed unjust to the daughters, and so they want to get clarification and ask for access or inheritance to that land. So the matter was presented to Moses and Eleazar. Notice now that when matters are brought up, they go to Moses and Eleazar. It used to be Moses and Aaron. So now it's Moses and Eleazar. After Moses dies, it'll be Joshua and Eleazar. So keep that. Well, those two are one, the leader or ruler, if you will, among the people and the high priest. So it's presented to them, the princes and all the congregation. The daughters requested that their father's name not be allowed to disappear. They asked for a land possession among their father's people. Moses presented the matter before the Lord. The Lord replied that the daughters of Zelophehad had spoken correctly, or that they were right to make their petition. You are surely to give them an inheritance among their father's people, the Lord said. The Lord then proceeded to provide further guidance on the rightful order of succession and other like kinds of cases. This was to be a law among them from then on. I didn't go into that, but if a man died having no offspring at all, it would go to his brother, and so it would go. And if it didn't have a brother, then it would go to his father or his father's brothers. It would just come back down through to cousins. But this is provided for here. Right of succession. Then a related question of concern arises about who the land would pass to when the daughters married. This became an issue for the people of Manasseh. The Lord acknowledged that this question also was a good question, and that here was the answer. They could marry whomsoever they would, only that it be among the clan of their father Manasseh. Since land inheritance normally would pass to sons, this provided an answer to the concern that these men had, that no land would pass out of their tribe and over to another tribe. They would be able to keep their land and their land inheritance. The comment I made was, notice that God did not address every such question initially in the giving of the law, but now he provides the answer when the issue has made itself known and needs an answer. And so God provides this answer at the proper time, when the good, right application can be made for their daily living. I would offer one other observation here. I didn't write it down, but we often hear about what were the rights of people in Old Testament times, especially women. It's interesting that the daughters could make such a petition. That petition was not squashed. They were given a hearing. Clearly, they were recognized as having rights to pursue their petition. I just want to pass that along, and you see other instances like this in the Old Testament. While there was a difference in the rights of men and women, they were not abused in some way, and this makes that very clear. Well, there comes then this next instance on page 2 that I talk about. God tells Moses to go up into this mountain called Abram, elsewhere called Nebo or Pisgah, and to look at the land which I have given to the children of Israel, that is, children of Jacob. And he says, after you have seen the land, speaking to Moses, you will be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was. You will not enter the land because you rebelled against what? My word. Go in the significance of every word God utters. You rebelled against my word in the wilderness, and you did not sanctify me before their eyes. Notice God's commitment to his judgment against Moses, the one that he had rendered earlier. But notice this. He shows compassion to Moses. He allows him to see the land which had meant so much to him in his leadership of the people all these years. And he offers something else. I call this, he offered him comfort. He said he would be gathered, one, to your people. Moses and all of us as we live, we know of those before us who have passed on. we think of being united with them. For those that had lived righteously, and Moses certainly knew that there were those in his family, was the case, he would be united with them. And he said, you would be gathered as your brother Aaron was. And Moses knew how Aaron was gathered as well, how he had died. So there's comfort in that part of this expression. Moses was ever the concerned leader. And he asked the Lord to appoint a man to be leader of the people for when he would be gone. Man to go and come, he said, before the people, that the people of the Lord would not be as a flock without a shepherd. Notice that a shepherd was the kind of leader Moses had been. All people knew what it meant to be a shepherd of sheep. That's what he had done for his father-in-law. He knew the people, that is the flock, still needed a shepherd leader. Obviously, we must remember that in all of this, the Lord is the true shepherd, was for them and is for us. God provides who this leader will be. He said it will be Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Holy Spirit. Moses was to lay his hand upon Joshua before all of the people and give him a charge before all. And to give him a charge was just simply to formally declare to him, this is the work and you are responsible. He will stand before the high priest, who will inquire of the Lord for him before Jehovah. The people will go at his word. That was to be the matter to be established. They weren't to look for somebody else. They were to be submissive to Joshua. Notice this point, that in all this discussion relative to the appointment of Joshua, that it brings up something in the way God would deal with Joshua versus the way he had dealt with Moses. Remember that with Moses, he had dealt with him in a very different manner. He had spoken to him face to face. Now Joshua will have to go to Eleazar the priest, who has the Urim and Thummim, to inquire of the Lord. And that's the point that Moses is making. You will find that this is the way it was to be for every leader thereafter. And those of us who've been through the foundations class will remember the numerous times when David was king that he inquired of the Lord. He always went to the priest to do that. So this is the beginning of this process that all leaders thereafter would follow. Now we come to something else. The people, remember when they were making their journey, skirting around Edom and land of Moab, they had encountered Arad, king of the Canaanites, and they had fought Og and Bashan and Sihon. Getting these a little bit confused, but anyway, you know what I'm saying. They had conquered this land, and Reuben and Gad saw that this land that they had conquered was very good for cattle, and they had very much cattle. They went to Moses and said, let us have this land that we've conquered on the east side of the Jordan River. Don't take us over Jordan. Moses at first did not understand the men's intent, feared the worst, feared that they were rebelling, didn't want to go forward, that they were just like their fathers had been, and that God would sentence them all as a consequence of this rebellion to wander even as before. And one can only imagine how he felt. The Bible records he was very upset, but one of the words that was used is he says, you have become a discourager of the hearts of the people. Anticipating he had understood their situation right. I found it interesting that the word that was used and marked in my Bible for discouragers, he says, you have broken their heart. Yes, can you break somebody's heart? Moses said they could with their actions. And I think he perceived it. Insofar as he had interpreted this correctly, he had perceived it correctly. That if they pursued in a rebellion as he understood it, they would break their brethren's heart, become a discourager, and that they would all be punished. Feared they would not do their part to help their brothers conquer all the land on the west side of Jordan. And they would in fact be a discouragement to all their brothers. Men of Gad and Reuben didn't stop though. They entreated Moses, and then they explained that they would build pens and corrals for their cattle, and cities or dwelling places for their little ones. And when that was done, then they would go armed and ready before the Lord. And I thought this was interesting. I think the King James says ready and armed or armed. Anyway, the point being they would be armed and of an attitude to enter into battle. They would take not only their weapons of war, their equipment of war, but they would have the attitude and disposition to go before the Lord and do battle until we have brought them, speaking of their brethren, unto their place. They said, we will not return home till all the children have their inheritance. We will not inherit with them there. This is what we want. Talking about what's on the east side of the Jordan River. Moses then accepts them, what they said, but he warned them that they must do as they had agreed. This agreement was one that had been heard and presented before the Lord, so it was as they agreed before the Lord. To not do so would be a sin. Be sure their sins would find them out. So we find the land of Bashan, where the giants were, and Sihon, where the Amorites were, was now bestowed upon the tribes of Gad and Reuben. There is a portion that was bestowed also upon the half-tribe of Manasseh, that is, one of his sons, Maker. And that land lay between Gad and Reuben, but it was a land that we don't have an explanation clearly in the text, but it's Amorite land between Gad and Reuben, and it either has been conquered or is to be conquered, and they are participants in that, so that land will become theirs. So we have now Gad and Reuben, half-tribe of Manasseh, on the east side of the Jordan River. I want to make this point here that recall that Ephraim and Manasseh were the sons of Joseph and were each reckoned as full tribes for the planned land distribution. Joseph, having received a double portion as his birthright, being the firstborn of Rachel, when Jacob blessed all his sons. So Joseph getting a double portion made it possible that he would have two shares, and then each son would have a share in the land of promise. This land that we talked about here is for the descendants of Maker, and would henceforth be referred to as Manasseh beyond Jordan. The rest of Manasseh would inherit in the land of Canaan on the west side of the Jordan. So we've taken care of two tribes and a half. That leaves nine tribes and a half on the west side of the Jordan we're going to deal with. Next comes up a topic that is interesting, and Charles, being a map maker and a cartographer, I wish that we had a good map in here to go through all of this. But if you have the lesson book and you look at pages 5 and 7, there are maps there that you should use, and I haven't mentioned this before, should go back and forth between these lessons and these maps to see that these are real places being talked about, and that this is a journey that you can see almost step by step as it progressed. So these are not just made up things that we're talking about. So as this thing comes to an end, they're camped on the plains of Moab. Moses lays out the record he has kept. You don't think about somebody being busy. All of the things he had to do to lead the people, but he kept a record of all of this that he now sets in front of them. Of all the places they had camped while they had journeyed for these 40 years after leaving Egypt and coming to this point. Bob makes this point that much is sometimes made over the differences with the listing given here versus the one, and it's not really a list, it's just several place names in Numbers chapter 11 and 12. That perhaps needs a clarification here if you want to make a note. But the list has many more names than we noted in the previous narrative text. This is reasonable because we noted before that the narrative seems to skip over many years of the wilderness wandering, about 38 years worth. Many places cannot be definitely located because they were just camping places and not named cities of record. In their wilderness wandering, God led them deliberately into the wilderness, not into a place of named settled communities. Their encampments were often unnamed until Israel gave them names, such as, for example, the place of Taberah, the place of burning. Many places cannot be pinpointed with preciseness. And I'm referring to information Bob has given us. This is nothing new. But the general direction of travel can be perceived as we put together or link together segments of travel that we do know and understand and order of time. The Numbers 33 listing of places includes 19 places not identified elsewhere in the book of Numbers. The most plausible explanation for this difference is that Numbers 33 incorporates camping places in the wilderness wandering between Kadesh Barnea, where they rebelled, and then where they picked back up to resume their progress towards the promised land 38 years later. Moses, and given this listing of places where they went, concludes this listing with this admonition from the Lord. He said that the Lord said, when you cross over Jordan, there's these things you must do. You must drive out the inhabitants. You must destroy all their carved statues, fire cast images. Destroy all their shrines. And by that he's referring to the places of their idol worship. You are to take possession of the land and live in it. Land is to be inherited by lot, by the casting of lots, by the various tribes. More people in a tribe, they will get more land. Land within the tribal inheritance is to be distributed also by lot. Once a tribe has its location, then all the families in that tribe get their land by casting of lots. God then issued a warning. He said, if you fail to drive the people out of the land, then they will become, one, pieces of trash in your eyes. Remember, think just for a moment. Sometimes you get something bad in your eyes, you just can't stand it till you get it out. It hurts so bad. Thorns in your sides, they will become a serious problem for you. Warning, if you do not do this, then I will do to you as I had planned to do. And I provided this note here. I thought it was useful. It's good here to recall that the reason Israel was to inherit this land was all the land, first of all, we must remember, belongs to God by virtue of the fact He's creator in the first place. And He's also the judge of all the earth. And He had determined Canaanites should be dispossessed of their land as the judgment for their wickedness. He told Abraham back in Genesis that his children would go down into Egypt and be there through the fourth generation because the time of wickedness had, for the Canaanites, they had not yet filled up the cup of wrath. So God foreknew when the wickedness would reach such a point, they would be deserving of that judgment and dispossession of that land. And of course, if they ultimately, that is, the Israelites, behave no better than the ones they dispossessed, have this assurance, God will dispossess them also. Borders of the land are set forth. I didn't go through the trouble of listing all of those, but I ask you, if you have time and want to study this, God basically lays out here for these people in this land boundaries or borders for the land they will occupy. How far east, how far west? Of course, the east side of that, which was on the west side of the Jordan, would be the Jordan River. The west side in parts would be the Mediterranean Sea. Then on the south side, he named those limits. On the north side, he gave other limits, but he does it by landmarks, tells them how far they can go, the land that will be theirs. And third bullet here, though the people here inherited all the land God intended to give them in the days of Joshua, it was not till the days of David and Solomon that they would eventually control the land as far north as God had described. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 8 through 9 shows God's plan had always allowed for them to expand their land as they became strong enough to hold it. Final note is that 40 years has been counted from the time the people left Egypt. On the one hand, they had wandered for about 38 and a half years after their rebellion. However, the rebellion also meant that the first 1.5 years was counted as lost. They had made no forward progress. It's counted as pointless travel. So all told, it had been pointless travel up to the point where they were ready to enter into the promised land. It took 40 years to get to that point. Then God appoints men to be in charge of dividing the land. He now speaks to Moses and gives him specific names of a prince from each tribe to help Eleazar and Joshua to divide out the land. there were no names for the tribes on the east side of the Jordan. That's just my observation. I went through and checked that since that land had already been allocated. There are no princes from Gad or Reuben or to represent Maker. Now, this only deals with princes for the 9.5 tribes on the west side of the Jordan. The cities for the Levites. Levites, God had said, they would not get land because He, God, was their inheritance. But while still on the plains of Moab, God told Moses, command the children of Israel to give cities with surrounding lands or fields for livestock and so forth to the Levites for an inheritance. They will live in these cities. That means they don't live out in the land, they live in the cities. Six cities will be used as cities of refuge. You will give them, he said, 42 more cities. This is an observation on my part, but remember when we counted the Levites, there were 23,000 males above the age of 23. It is quite likely that this census count is what God used. We don't know the mind of God, but would have used to determine how many cities they would need. And he's the one says 42 more cities besides the cities of refuge. So a total of 48 cities are to be provided for the Levites to live in. God would know what they needed. These cities will be taken according to the number of cities in the possession of each tribe. That is, those tribes with more cities would provide more cities for the Levites. So we see that the Levites didn't receive a tribal territorial inheritance, just as God had said, but God has still provided for them. He provides them places to have as their own. For their dedicated service, out of the Levites would be the priest and all those serving the priest in the tabernacle. Their income to sustain them will come from the sacrifices to the Lord and for tithes and other such things. Notice this, and I think this is a very interesting observation. One of the Levite tasks was to teach the law, people the law. You may remember that with Ezra. Came back from the captivity. He and the Levites got together and spent that time there teaching the people the law, carrying this out. They understood that they were to know the law and to teach it. So they're to teach the people the law. By giving them their cities among the tribes scattered up and down throughout the land and proportioned in number according to the size of the tribes, God was not only giving them a place to live, also providing a means of access to keep the law alive in the hearts of the people. Very thoughtful thing here. This was to be an obligation the Levites would be expected to live up to. I remember in the days of Hosea, God said, my people have perished for lack of knowledge. They didn't always do that. Then there's instructions given relative to the cities of refuge. Cities of refuge were places to be set aside where one could flee from the avenger of blood when one had accidentally killed another person until the matter could be brought before the people and be properly judged. Six cities were to be established as cities of refuge. God provided there would be three on each side of the Jordan River. They were to be accessible not only to the Israelite, but to the stranger and the visitor in the land. The stranger is one who might live in their midst, but not be an Israelite. The visitor would, of course, be the one passing through. These were accessible to all three classes of people. They were to be used for the case where one deliberately caused death, that is, murder. Whether the murder came about because one picked up a weapon in one's hand and deliberately struck one such that he died, then God said, he shall die by the avenger of blood. If one killed another due to hatred or jealousy, then he shall die by the avenger of blood. If one kills another without apparent motive, and it appears accidental, then he is not to be treated as a murderer. He will be delivered. Now, I assume here that what's being talked about, we know that he did not have the motive of murder. It appears in every way to be accidental. Once that's determined, he shall not be treated as a murderer. He would be delivered from the avenger of blood. Nevertheless, though he is found innocent, the killer is constrained to the city of refuge until the high priest dies. There may be something here that we don't think about, and I'll mention that a little bit later. If he leaves the city, his blood, that is by the avenger blood, shall be on his own head when he falls into the hands of the avenger blood. The avenger blood, if he found him outside the city of refuge, was not accountable if he took his life. You may remember the incident of Shimei, who cursed David. And when David died, he gave Solomon a specific charge to deal with Shimei. Shimei, I believe this is around 1 Kings 4 or 5, eventually betrays Solomon's orders and leaves the city. Solomon told him, build a house in the city of Jerusalem and stay there. If you ever cross the brook Kidron, your blood shall be upon your head. This is the same kind of thing. Shimei's rebellion at that order showed his unworthiness as far as his right to continue to live. And I think that's really what's behind this here. If there was some doubt, you couldn't prove, there were no witnesses, and you couldn't confirm a murder was actually there as far as motive and other evidence, then he was to be declared innocent. But what happens if he wasn't? Can't execute him if you can't prove it. What if he is? This constraint would be a real trial for a person of rebellion and who doesn't want to be subjected to authority. They would eventually be subject to leaving that city just like Shimei left Jerusalem. God has foreseen such an attitude of a person who might not could be determined to be fully determined to be guilty. This was a law to be a law among the people. None were to die except at the testimony of two or more. No fine could be paid to redeem the life of a murderer or to release one from the city of refuge. Thus the people were to keep the land pure. The shedding of innocent blood pollutes the land, God said. And this is mentioned several times in the Old Testament. Matter of death of an innocent person is never resolved until the guilty is executed, God said. You will not defile the land given to you. I, Jehovah, dwell among you. Three cities of refuge in particular in Transjordan, that is on the east side of the Jordan, are mentioned in Deuteronomy 4, 41 through 43, and we pick that up here and cover it. Since the land on the east side of the Jordan had already been conquered and divided out, then the planned cities of refuge on the east side didn't have to wait to pick them. They could be set aside immediately. Moses therefore set aside these three cities, Bezer and the land of Reuben, Ramoth and Gilead for the land of Gad, and Golan and Bashan for Makkah of the half-tribe of Manasseh. Bob makes this point, and you see Moses actually refers to this a number of times. Soon in the history of Israel, all the land on the east side of the Jordan, where Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh live, would eventually be called Gilead. And you will see that as Moses' speeches are made elsewhere in the book of Deuteronomy, he begins to refer to those people as living in the land of Gilead. That gets us to the end of our class. And next week we will pick up the speeches of Moses before his death. You might call them the farewell speeches, the farewell sermon. I haven't looked, but I don't think we'll cover that all in one class. But that's a very significant message we want to try to get our arms around. This last message Moses has before he leaves. Appreciate your quietness and your attention. This is hard, I'm sure, to take this approach to teaching.